This interview with Sir Bernard Lovell is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
Sir Bernard, you first came here to Jodrell Bank in 1945. What was it that brought you here?
The incident that brought me here really began in 1939, when I'd been taken away from my researches in Manchester to the... And I was at one of the giant radar defence stations at Staxton Road in Yorkshire. I happened to be in the operations room on that fateful day when Prime Minister Chamberlain declared that we were at war with Germany in early September 1939. And on the cathode ray tube screen were lots of sporadic echoes. I asked the operator why he did not report to fighter command that we were about to be bombed. And he said, oh, they're not echoes from aircraft. They're what we call transient echoes. And I thought then that if we ever survive the war, radar might be a good means of investigating what I've been trying to do in the laboratory in Manchester. That is the study of very large cosmic ray air showers. Right.
And did you find problems in Manchester with the radar equipment?
Well, after the war... 6 years later, I came back. I had completely forgotten this incident in 1939, and I began to operate the Wilson sound chambers, which I'd been using before the war. And then Patrick Blackett appeared, and he said, oh, I thought you were going to try this new method. Well, I'd been working on centimeter radar for Bomber Command and Coastal Command, and what I wanted to investigate the ionization from the cosmic ray showers was a long wavelength radar. So I borrowed from a friend of mine who'd been working with the Army Operations Research Group, two of the radar sets which had been used in the defense of London, directing the AK-AK guns, right. And they worked on 4 meters. So I had in November of 1945, the Army towed these trailers to the quadrangle of the University of Manchester. I set them up, but the cathode ray tube was obliterated by interference from the trams, which were then running past the university. Now, I asked the bursar of the university if the university owned any land remote from the city, and he directed me to the botanist who was operating the botanical researches in 10 acres of land at a place called Jodrell Bank. Well, I got permission to bring the traders here for 2 weeks. In those days, it was believed that we, all of us who had been away during the war, ought to get back and help with the restoration of the teaching in universities. And that's why it was 2 weeks. Well, the 2 weeks, for circumstances which are really quite remarkable, it's all a different story, have now extended into near 50 years.
What was it then that inspired you to build a giant, fully steerable telescope?
I had a young helper from who'd been with me in the wartime, who was an expert on aerials. And with the help of a labourer, we built ourselves a 218-foot diameter telescope, which was radio telescope, which was fixed to the ground. This transit telescope looked only vertically, and we could only cover a small area of the sky. And it was this desire to have a telescope of that size at least, which would look all around the sky, that led to what is here now, the 250-foot steerable telescope.
Were there any problems during its construction?
Well, the first problem was to find someone who was willing to undertake to do it. I thought I'd been involved with fairly big machines and aircraft and so on. I thought there'd be no problem. This was not the case. I consulted many of the major engineering firms in the country, and they were either too busy, as they said, on work of national importance, or said I was proposing something which was impossible. And eventually I was introduced to H.C. Husband, and he looked at the transit telescope, and I said, you know, people say it's impossible to make a thing of this size steerable. And I still remember his reply. He said, oh, well, I don't know. About the same difficulty as building a swing bridge across the Thames at Westminster. And that was the beginning of the Engineering Association, which led many years later to the telescope which is here now. But the difficulties in building were immense. We really were then in 1950 working at the limits, and in many cases beyond the limits, of what was technological and engineeringly feasible. And there were enormous problems connected with the construction, stresses and strains, and maintaining what would then be regarded as quite a poor shape to the bell. There had also been one or two changes in design, which is entirely my fault. Mm-hmm. One connected, in fact, with the discovery of radio emissions from space, working on very, very much shorter wavelengths than I had anticipated. That was the discovery of the radio emission from neutral hydrogen on a wavelength of 21 centimeters, which obviously was going to become of great importance and has indeed done so. The other problem was that the original estimates of the cost of the telescope were hopelessly inadequate. And although the final cost was only about £700,000, which now seems a small amount of money, you've got to multiply that by nearly a factor of 15 or 20, I'd overspent by a considerable amount of money. And that nearly led to a disaster.
So what do you think were the major achievements of the telescope in its early years?
I'd like to mention two. The first one was really technological and not scientific. When the Russians launched Sputnik, it transpired to my amazement that we had the only telescope in the Western world which had the capability of detecting the carrier rocket. And the carrier rocket was, in fact, the world's first intercontinental ballistic missile. And this message went home to the press and so on. Instead of being vilified, we were filled with praise. And that led us into circumstances which made the telescope well known because of our subsequent association with both the Russians and the American space programs. But indeed, they represented only about 15% of the total operational time of the telescope in those early years. And the most important scientific achievement was undoubtedly the discovery using this large steerable telescope in conjunction with smaller telescopes separated at increasing distances from Jodrell Bank that led to the discovery of very, very small diameter, very, very small angular diameters of the intense radio sources remote in the universe. And this in 1961-62 led to the discovery of an entirely new class of objects deep in the universe which became known as quasars. And for the last 40 years they formed a major subject of investigation everywhere in the world.
We hear rumours that perhaps the telescope once had a role in national defence. Is that the case?
Indeed it is. And I can tell you now, because it was more than 40 years ago, I was then one of the scientific advisors to Chief of Air Staff, and in the late 1950s he said, is there any chance that we could make use of your telescope? And I said, why? He said, well, Fylingdales, the ballistic missile early warning station, is hindered by strikes, and if we have your permission, we'd like to use your telescope instead until it's available. And I said, of course, we can, if you can tell us where the Soviets have the missiles directed against London, we can tell you when they lift off, but we can do nothing else. And I said, neither can you. He said, no, but if you can give us a few minutes' warning, we could save a million lives in London. Where our agents knew precisely where the missiles were directed against London, and of course our liaison with the Chief of Air Staff covered the acute period of the severe Cold War, including the Cuban crisis. And that, of course, was an unforgettable occasion. Fortunately, in about a year afterwards, Fylingdales became operational, and we were then released from all national commitments of that kind.
How long did you expect the telescope to last when it was first built?
I would have been pleased if it had been useful astronomically for 15 years. And the engineers said, my dear fellow, you'll be lucky if the structure lasts for 15 years. Well, there you are. apart from a renovation, in fact, in 1970-71, the telescope's been in operational status now since it was first used in October 1957. And I hope it will go on being useful for another 50 years.